But I will give one instead. The Dharma is so vast. And the Buddha offered so many different teachings, perspectives, ways into understanding the Dharma. And so in terms of reflecting on refuge in the Dharma, we thought we'd spend several days looking at different ways to explore the understanding of Dharma and how it serves as refuge. The Buddha's own, or the description of the Buddha's motivation for his practice, for the search that he underwent, was to try to find an answer to the question, is it possible to be free from dukkha? This stress, unease, dissatisfaction, unreliability. And so many of his teachings were framed around this question, framed around exploring what is dukkha? How does it happen? Is it possible to be free from it? And how might that be possible? What might the conditions for that be? Last night, Gil talked about some of the conditions that the Dharma encourages us to put together so that we can experience this freedom from suffering, that we can have these insights. And the insights aren't so much, you know, useful in and of themselves to just understand impermanence. The insight of impermanence is helpful because it releases us from the wish to cling to things that are not permanent. The wish to cling to things that are impermanent, and that clinging, that very clinging to impermanent experience or things, creates this suffering. And so the insights themselves are the way that the mind releases suffering. And the Buddha expressed kind of the overview of his teachings in the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. It arises with conditions. And it's possible to be released from that suffering. And there are conditions that allow for that release. In this first noble truth, he said not only there is suffering, the truth of suffering, but in the first discourse he said to have given, he points to understanding suffering as being central in this exploration to become free of suffering. And so we don't get free of suffering by somehow magically, like, transcending all of these experiences and states of mind that are dukkha. But by understanding suffering, and understanding suffering here not meaning intellectual understanding, but understanding through meeting with this quality, capacity of wise mindfulness. And that understanding is one of the conditions that leads to the freedom from suffering. And so understanding suffering, how it comes to be, what are the conditions that put suffering together, that's a piece of what the Buddha taught and what I'd like to explore this evening, this afternoon. The teaching of dependent origination, which is a teaching of a detailed exposition of the conditions that come together that lead us into stress, suffering, unease, dissatisfaction. It's essentially kind of a detailed psychology of the usual way our minds work. A detailed description of how our minds usually work, and I think of it as a teaching. It's not a practice so much. I mean, we don't practice dependent origination. It's not something we do to help free us from suffering, but it is kind of a description of the usual functioning of our minds when we are unaware. And the Buddha taught it, I think, because it's useful to bring these processes and patterns into consciousness so that we can begin to recognize them. And the very recognition of how these things work creates the conditions for them to start to release. I mentioned the other day that this mindfulness has this power of when we meet, wise mindfulness has this power when we meet suffering, when we meet reactivity, we meet flavors of greed, aversion, and delusion. It creates the conditions for them to transform, to release. And so the teaching of dependent origination is kind of a help to help us understand the processes that we are undergoing so much of the time. And it's useful for a couple of reasons, probably more than a couple. Useful to recognize this pattern or understand this pattern. It describes suffering as arising dependent on conditions. It describes a human pattern. And so right there, those two pieces. First, that there are conditions that put suffering together. It's not random. It has a kind of a lawfulness to it. And we're not alone in this process. He looked into his own mind, understood this pattern in his own mind, and also understood this isn't just about the way my mind works. This seems to describe how human minds work when they're not mindful, aware. When ignorance is present, this is how human minds work. And so we can begin to see the impersonal nature of our suffering. Or hearing this teaching, we might recognize, yeah, I see that. I, yep, This is describing the way my mind works. And just hearing that somebody 2,600 years ago described this, to me, it's like, wow, yeah, I'm really not alone here. It's not personal. And then hearing that the Buddha described, yes, it's possible to be free from this pattern because it's a conditioned cycle. Suffering arises in dependence on conditions. If the conditions are released, the suffering will be released. And so the conditions are not locked in place. We do not have to be locked into this condition of suffering. And so the teaching of dependent origination, I would say it's a complex teaching. It's got 12 links, and I'm going to do my best to cover them all. That's a lot, so it's going to be a brief. It's going to be an overview. And it's there was a kind of a famous exchange between the Buddha and Ananda on this topic of dependent origination. And Ananda, coming to the Buddha one day, said, "It's wonderful, it's amazing how profound this dependent origination is and how profound it appears. And yet it appears to me as clear as clear." And the Buddha said, "Don't say that, Ananda. It is through," he said, "this dependent origination is profound and appears profound, but it is through not understanding, not penetrating this truth, that this generation has become like a tangled ball of string. Tangled like coarse grass, unable to pass beyond states of woe." And so here the Buddha effectively equates seeing dependent origination with, or seeing how this works through penetrating this understanding of how this works. This is understanding suffering, the First Noble Truth. This is, I think of this teaching, dependent origination, as being an elaboration of how suffering comes to be, the Second Noble Truth. But it helps us to understand, which is the injunction of the First Noble Truth, it helps us to understand suffering. And so in this, he's saying that it is through not understanding this that we're all tangled up. We suffer. Elsewhere it's said that the Buddha said, "One who sees dependent origination sees the Dharma. One who sees the Dharma sees dependent origination." Essentially equating this understanding of dependent origination with freedom. When we deeply understand this truth, again, not intellectually, but see it, see this at work and understand the functioning, the mind releases. And so, looking at this, it's a teaching, as Gil said last night, that the refuge in the Dharma has, you know, the Dharma has three sides, the teaching, the practices, and the understanding. And this is a teaching, but the teaching itself points a way, points a direction to practice and understanding. So it kind of contains the three together. And so the chain of dependent origination describes the conditions that put suffering together. And as I said, it's not locked in it's not deterministic. Choices that we make, choices that that are made in our practice, and the conditions Gil spoke about last night are some of those conditions that lead to different choices that change the conditions around the arising of suffering. And so this teaching of dependent origination, the 12 links, starts with ignorance. I'm just going to name them pretty much right now and then go back. Ignorance conditions mental formations. Mental formations condition consciousness. Consciousness conditions processes of body and mind. Processes of body and mind condition the six sense bases. Six sense bases condition contact with sense experience, sense impression. Sense impressions condition feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience conditions craving, wanting. Craving conditions clinging. Clinging conditions becoming. Becoming conditions birth. Birth conditions aging and death. And the entire mass of suffering. That's how he puts it. And so the entire chain is rooted in ignorance. There's a kind of a way that this teaching, while the Buddha didn't explicitly teach dependent origination as a cycle, it can be understood as a cycle, because when we suffer, there's a place in the teachings where the Buddha said, suffering conditions bewilderment or ignorance or search. You know, when we suffer, the condition of suffering can lead us in one of two directions. It can either lead us into the impetus to find a path that will free us from suffering, or it can lead us right back into ignorance and through this chain of suffering. And so it can be understood as cyclic, this teaching. In the suttas, in the teachings of the Buddha, the discourses of the Buddha, this teaching of dependent origination, or teachings from the suttas and the commentary, support an understanding of this teaching in two different ways. One way is as a description of how suffering and the conditioning forces of ignorance and suffering act across time, vast time even. It's understood to talk about how ignorance in a previous life can lead on to suffering birth in a new life, leading on to more suffering and more birth in another life. And so it is spoken about as being kind of the cycle of rebirth, the cycle of existences. This chain of dependent origination is understood to speak to that kind of conditioning across time. But it is also understood to speak to how a description it speaks to a description of how suffering is created in a moment. Moment by moment, in this very moment. And in a way, my understanding of this is that when ignorance arises, suffering is already arising. When ignorance arises, it's like the entire chain of 12 links is co-arising with it. That's sometimes dependent origination is called dependent co-arising. I think speaking to this, the nature of the conditioning power of ignorance, when ignorance is arising in the mind, already the mind is in the state of suffering. Maybe not consciously recognized, but obscured and caught in patterns and habits that tend to perpetuate suffering and ignorance. And so it's understood both ways, both as acting over time, and we can see this process also acting over time in our own lives, and acting in a moment. The description of how suffering is created in this very life is the one that I most resonate with. And, you know, I don't particularly have any experience in my own practice or in my own intuition about previous lives or the cycle of rebirth. That's not part of my direct experience. And yet the way this teaching speaks to moment suffering really resonates with me. And this teaching has been a profound part of my practice. And so that's what I hope to share with you in this discussion. And so I'm going to start this exploration of these links of dependent origination in a kind of unconventional way. Traditionally, the teaching begins with ignorance. But those first few links, I find, can be a little bit obscure. And so I'm going to start talking about it where it's a little easier to enter in, where we can maybe recognize our experience. And that is, you know, we have this body and mind. We have these six sense doors. We have our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our skin. And we have the mind. And because we have those six sense doors, and because we're conscious, we experience sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and experience things happening in the mind. So this is two links right there. There is the six sense bases, the five usual bases of sense experience, plus in Buddhist understanding, the mind is a sixth sense. The sixth sense base, and contact. Because we have these sense bases, and because we're conscious, because we're not corpses. I mean, corpses have these sense bases, but we need consciousness to have this contact. So because we have these six sense bases, and because we're conscious, contact happens. Like we don't have to try to have seeing happen. It happens. It's a natural co-arising. When consciousness and sense bases are there, we have these sense impressions. So we have contact. So based on these contacts, again, very naturally, very much a human part of our experience, every single sense impression has a feeling tone to it, kind of a flavor of either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So again, this is just the human experience, actually broader than human experience. You know, probably this flavor of, you know, having a body and some form of consciousness and the sense bases and contact and feeling is probably pretty universal across living beings. We can see animals feeling pain and pleasure. And so this is just the way beings work. We have the sense impressions, and then we have these feeling tones. Experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's a very straightforward and simple aspect of our experience, actually, but often unnoticed. It's not something we typically see consciously. Based on that feeling tone, the Buddha describes another kind of natural process of when there's pleasant experience, we tend to like it and want more of it. When there's unpleasant sense experience, we tend to not like it and want to separate from it to get rid of it. This is craving at work. And again, it's a pretty natural part of our human experience to that have this movement, you know, and again, probably pretty much based in life as well. It's, I mean, this movement towards pleasant and away from unpleasant. You might see that in something as simple as an amoeba moving, you know, towards nourishment and away from a noxious environment. In our system, in our human system, this wanting is not hardwired. This movement towards pleasant and away from unpleasant is optional. But it is very strongly conditioned at a very deep level. We can see, you know, evolutionarily, at a very deep level, we have this tendency to move towards pleasant, away from unpleasant. And so it's a natural part of our process. But fortunately for us as human beings, it's also an optional part of the process. So based on that wanting, that craving, that's another link. We've six sense bases, condition impressions, sense impressions, or contact conditions, feeling conditions, craving or wanting. Based on wanting, we typically move to get, or separate. So the craving leads us to act, to cling, to move towards what we like, to move away from what we don't like. I think of craving and clinging as kind of an intensification of the same kind of phenomenon. Bhikkhu Bodhi describes a kind of an analogy about this intensification. He says that craving is like the mind state of a thief, or the action or the movement of a thief that is reaching out to take something. See something it wants to take, and it's reaching towards it. Clinging is when it's picked it up, when the thief has picked up the object. So it's kind of an intensification, a moving from wanting something to latching onto it. So this is clinging. Once we've clung to something, there's a kind of a process of intentions and actions in our mind that kind of rally in the service of this clinging to figure out how to produce or control things. This is becoming. This movement of, okay, got this thing. Okay, now how do I make sure I can keep it? So it's kind of like the mind state of the thief trying to figure, okay, now it's in my hand. What do I do now? How do I get out of here safely? So this is the becoming piece of the intentions and actions that are beginning to form, beginning to swirl in order to serve this clinging. So the movement of mind that serves the clinging. Clinging is happening, and how do we support the clinging? That's becoming. So becoming is an interesting process, and it's interesting. It seems to have a kind of a pleasant feeling to it. We like becoming. As we cling to something and our intentions and actions kind of rally in the service of clinging, it's like, oh yeah, I know how I'll do this. I can figure this out. I've got this down. So there's a feeling of control, of understanding something or knowing something or having figured something out. That's this feeling of becoming. It's pleasant. It's got this quality of, yes, I've got it. I know how to make this work. From becoming, we actually follow through on those intentions and actions. And the next link is birth. We take birth in, and in this case, it's not thinking about dependent origination as a description of suffering in our moment-to-moment experience. Birth here is understood as the birth into a sense of self, an identification. I am the one who can control this. I've got this. I am the controller. I am the one who knows. I am the person who does things right. I got this. We can also, of course, take birth into identities that are not so pleasant. Like, I'm the one who's a failure. And in any case, this taking birth into a sense of me, it's got different flavors. It's got the flavor of I'm in control. And sometimes the Buddha talks about the sense of self having three kinds of flavors: I, me, and mine. And I think of the mine one as easy, that I'm the one who has things. I'm the one who possesses things. That's a pretty obvious form of self. The one who has something is being mine. The I is also relatively obvious. It's the one, to me, I understand the I side of this birth as being the one who feels in control, or the controller, the doer, the actor. That one that is the onward leading actor in our system, and the identification with being that. And there are actions that happen in our experience, as I talked about the other day, the experience of having your bladder get full, and then you might just notice the conditions leading to that, and then get up and move and feel like the sense of, wow, who decided to do that? You know, it just happened. Or you might think, oh, I'm the one who needs to decide to do this. And so the sense of self enters in there. So in any case, I think of the I as being the identification around the agent, the one who's in control, the one who does. And then the me is an identification with being the one things happen to, and of being the hapless, oh, poor me, you know, I just sit here and all these things happen to me. So the one who feels, the one who, it's not so much about doing, but just the one who is being impinged on. That's another way we feel a sense of self. Sometimes that comes with a feeling of not being in control. So that's another flavor of this birth. With this birth, suffering is inevitable. Whether it comes from the obvious separation of something that we considered I or me or mine, if it comes from the obvious separation of something we owned, maybe, you know, in terms of that, the mine sense of self, in terms of the I sense of self, at some point, impermanent, unreliable, out of control kind of nature of life is going to kick in, and we're going to discover that we're not really in control, that we can't really always decide what to do. We don't always know. And so that kind of burst that bubble of, oh yeah, I am in control. And that can create a sense of suffering. Like, oh, I'm, what did I do wrong? We may blame ourselves, we may blame others for that out of control feeling. Or perhaps the suffering comes from the outright arising of a sense of self that contains suffering, like, I'm a failure, self-hatred. So this birth into a sense of self will inevitably lead to suffering, this next link in the chain. Another piece around this birth I want to just mention, because I think it's an important piece when we take birth into a sense of self. You know, I talked about those three, I, me, mine. Another way that we take birth that may not be so obvious is we give birth to other. We give birth to they, them, the separation. That sense of other, if you sometimes when we are taking birth into a sense of self, a sense of identification, we don't experience so much as I or me, but we experience they, them. They're creating problems. They're doing something wrong. I'm not measuring up to how good they are, or you know. So there's this othering happening. Or that I'm better than they are, sort of comparison kind of happening. And so othering, sometimes we notice that, sometimes we can more easily recognize that we are othering somebody. When we are othering somebody, we are selfing. There is a birth of self. And so recognizing that process of othering is also a part of this exploration of identification. You know, this wheel of dependent origination, it's an interesting description because it's described often as how suffering comes to be. So the conditions that put into place the arising of suffering. But it's also understood to be a description of how the sense of self comes to be. Sometimes it's called the wheel of becoming, this identification, this process of identification. And so whether we're looking at or studying suffering to understand suffering, or we're studying a sense of I-ing or me-ing or my-ing, or we're studying a sense of othering, we are exploring aspects of this chain of dependent origination. So that gives you a little bit of a flavor for the unfolding of this chain. You know, this chain, it tends to perpetuate itself just in this part that we've talked about. And part of the way it perpetuates itself is based in this very natural movement related to feeling, the movement towards pleasant and away from unpleasant. Because many of the links in this chain of dependent origination, craving, clinging, becoming, they're mind states, their processes of mind, and they also have feeling tone associated with them. And so when our mind states are pleasant, we tend to like them and move toward them. When mind states are unpleasant, we want to figure out how to separate ourselves from them. And in this chain, wanting, kind of the movement from feeling to wanting, wanting itself, the feeling of wanting, when we actually open to, this is the experience of wanting. Not kind of caught by the wanting. When we're caught by the wanting, we're usually projecting into the future. When we're believing that getting that thing that I want is going to make things great, we're kind of living in the future. And we're living in a fantasy, and that fantasy is pleasant. And so it's kind of obscuring the fact that the experience of wanting is inherently unpleasant. As soon as wanting springs up, there's a feeling of lack, there's a feeling of offness. And so you can begin to notice this in your own experience. Wanting is unpleasant. Because wanting is unpleasant, we want to get rid of it. The most direct path to getting rid of wanting that we know of, that we've learned, is to get what we want. We get what we want. In that moment of getting what we want, we get a little bit of hit of pleasant because we got the thing. There's the having of the thing itself is possibly pleasant, or if we get rid of something we don't want, we maybe have that feeling of, oh yeah, that I got rid of that thing, so you know, the not having that unpleasant thing is somewhat pleasant. So the act of following through on the wanting and having it be successful creates a little bit of pleasantness. But the other part of the pleasantness that it creates is that the wanting goes away. When the wanting goes away, the suffering of the wanting, the unpleasantness of the wanting goes away. And I would propose to you that the vast majority of why we feel good when we get what we want is not so much because of the very fleeting moment of sense pleasure we get with having a thing, but because the wanting goes away. That's one part of how this cycle reinforces itself. And as long as we don't understand another way to shifting conditions around wanting, we're going to act on that wanting because we want to get rid of that wanting. Wanting tells us, I need to have that thing in order to be okay. This is kind of the movement of wanting. It's that's the delusion of wanting. In order to have that, in order to be okay, in order to have okayness in life, this being absolutely needs that experience, that state, that thing. Wanting is not going to tell you. If wanting goes away, it'll be okay. Wanting is completely caught up in its view that it needs that thing. So this is some of the wisdom that we can explore as we explore this chain of dependent origination. If we look at the wanting, watch the wanting. Wanting is an impermanent experience. We can watch wanting. Watch wanting. Feel the unpleasantness of wanting. Hang out with wanting. It's got a momentum. Like that car I talked about, it has momentum. But if we're exploring it in that wise mindfulness, it will pass of its own accord. And then we can feel the release of that wanting. At times in our practice, we can actually experience wanting letting go and wanting never having gotten the thing it wants, but it just releases. That experience is like being released from a vice grip. And you directly understand that freedom right there. And so this is part of how the cycle reinforces itself. Because of ignorance, we don't understand that the movement from wanting to clinging, that movement, is just perpetuating the cycle. Oh yeah, and then when we get something we want, we have it for a little while, the pleasure of that fades, and then it's like, well, you know, when was the last time I felt really good? Well, it's when I had something I wanted. We start looking around for something to want. This is a part of how this process works. So let's go back to the beginning of those links I haven't yet talked about. The first few links of the chain, ignorance, mental formation, consciousness. So as I said earlier, we can think of the chain as a cycle that suffering conditions ignorance. As the Buddha said, the suffering will tend to condition a search for a truth, a search for a way to be free from suffering. And if when we're experiencing suffering, we meet a teaching that says, yes, it's possible to be free from suffering. We may be ripe in that moment to hear that teaching and head in another direction. A direction towards cultivating those conditions Gil talked about last night, leading us away from suffering. But often, in a moment, we forget. Our habits of mind kind of descend, and we get caught again We get caught back in this cycle of suffering and ignorance. And so the suffering leads us back into confusion. So the main definition of ignorance is not understanding the Four Noble Truths, not knowing about suffering, not knowing about the origin of suffering, not knowing about the cessation of suffering, not knowing about the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called ignorance. And so the basic condition for suffering to lead to ignorance is that suffering is not understood. And so, as I just mentioned, you know, with ignorance, we're believing the story of wanting. We're believing the story of aversion. Have to get this. Got to get rid of this. So as ignorance is arising in the mind, I mentioned earlier as ignorance arises, essentially the entire chain is really happening in a moment. You know, as ignorance is arising in the mind, when ignorance is present in the mind and feeling, we meet feeling tone. When ignorance is present and feeling happens, we're going to act on wanting. Wanting's going to be born, we're going to move in that direction. And so very much ignorance is a key to this whole cycle. And so with ignorance as a condition, this not understanding a different way, habits, patterns around how to navigate our lives happen. Kind of the ways we each have figured out, this is how I go through life. These are the kinds of things I do. This is my strategy. Our habits and patterns are strategies that we figured out to try to navigate this terrain of suffering, to figure out how to get through life. And very often those strategies are informed by not really understanding how suffering works. And so this is mental formations. Ignorance conditions mental formations. A whole set of habits. The habits and patterns, our own personal habits and patterns that kind of lead us forward on this cycle. With mental formation as condition, consciousness comes to be. Now this one was an interesting one for me to reflect on. We can think of the habits and patterns of our mind, the way that the strategies that we use to live our lives, as kind of conditioning what we pay attention to, what comes into our consciousness. We tend to think of our consciousness, of our senses, kind of receiving experiences, kind of like recorders or like cameras and microphones, and you know, we tend to think we think we're just kind of these bare receivers. But our mental formations really influence what comes in to our consciousness. Given certain mental formations, certain habits of mind, some things will be present for our consciousness and other things won't be. And so we all, I think, have the Buddhist personality types talks about strategies, you know, of most of us have strategy based on one of three conditions, greed, aversion, or delusion. And so myself, I've got I'm the aversive type. So that means that my strategy has basically been, how do I get rid of things? How do I get rid of unpleasant things so that I can be happy? That's kind of the main strategy that my mind figured out was a good way to navigate life. How do I get rid of unpleasant things? And so based on that strategy, what happens, what tends to happen, and we can kind of check these personality types in a way by doing this simple example. You know, when you walk into a room you've never been in before, what do you tend to notice? Me, I tend to notice what I don't like. I walk into the room and I think, it's a little messy in here. Not dark, not bright enough. I'd like it brighter. So the mind orients to the things it finds unpleasant in order to fix them so that it can be okay. For those of us who have kind of a movement towards the greedy personality type, might tend to walk in the room and notice the things you like. So again, you know, it's like the condition of the mind influences what we take in. This can happen. This happens at a very subtle level, and all the time. An example of this kind of thing, even something as simple as an agenda in our mind, can prevent us from seeing some things. Like, consciousness will not arise on some things, but will arise on other things. So the example, I watched this TV program some months ago on perception, and there was an example that they gave. They were doing a lot of things to demonstrate how perception worked and, you know, play along with it. And so one of the things was to play along with seeing a magic trick. Now, can you see, can you understand how this magic trick works? How does this person create the illusion that they put their keys in a cup and the keys disappear and it's replaced by liquid? How do they do that? So the guy's on the screen doing the magic trick. I'm watching, you know, see if I can see how that works. And I think maybe I see something. I'm not sure that I really figured it out, but I was pretty focused on it, and I might have figured out how the magic trick worked. But after that, they did show us how the magic trick worked, but then they said, but did you see the guy in the giant bunny suit walk by while that magic trick was going on? I had not seen the guy in the giant bunny suit walk by. Consciousness had been focused. This is called selective attention. It's a natural function of our minds to, based on agendas, based on habits, based on mental formations, we see some things and we don't, or we experience some things in consciousness and we do not experience other things in consciousness. This is my understanding of what it means that mental formations condition consciousness. So with consciousness as a condition, mental and physical processes unfold. What we take in, what is taken in our consciousness, influences our bodies and our minds. And so, you know, the habit of orienting towards things I don't like, mind orients towards picking up on unpleasant things. The mind picks up on something unpleasant. One time I was doing walking meditation and turned around. I knew the mind was in this aversive state, and it turned around and saw a pair of shoes at the other end of the walkway. And the mind exploded in rage. Who put those shoes at the end of my walking path? So consciousness had been influenced by that mental state and then conditioned further rage. It was an aversive state in the mind that conditioned rage in the mind. This something like anger arising in our minds conditions our body. You know, when we get angry, our face tends to get contorted. Our body gets tight. Heat and pressure rises up. So it impacts the physical processes of experience. It impacts our mind. It impacts what else we take in. You know, when there's rage in the mind, that further conditions what comes into consciousness. It impacts how we feel about things. Anger in the mind tends to make conditions unpleasant. It influences how we perceive things, how we recognize things. And so the state of consciousness conditions our mental and physical processes. And so now we have come back to the beginning of our cycle. We have this body and mind with mental and physical processes and our sense bases, and we're taking in a sense impression. And you can see now that it's not so simple as just a bare little sense impression with, is it pleasant or unpleasant? The whole structure of our mind is already primed for certain things. Orient towards certain kinds of experience. Again, this is a way in which the cycle tends to perpetuate itself. And so we're not starting from a neutral place as a sense impression is contacting us. We have all kinds of agendas, beliefs, views, mental states that are there that influence how we receive experience. Kind of filtering how we look at things. And so this cycle reinforces itself. And yet it's not hopeless. It is not hopeless because it is conditioned phenomenon, and because ignorance is the kind of the seed at the base of all of it. There is this possibility of waking up, hearing a teaching that helps to undermine ignorance. I mean, even something is hearing, for me, the very first teaching I heard was something around what I mentioned the other night, one of the perspectives of wise mindfulness, of just, you know, noticing what's happening in the present moment as happening in the present moment. The teaching was, you know, well, you're experiencing reactive mind states, just notice that they're happening in the present moment. So that is a little bit of wisdom. It's a perspective of wisdom that comes to bear on the unfolding of this cycle, and it has a radical impact as we bring mindfulness to any point in this cycle. Often, the teaching of dependent origination, there's an emphasis on freeing ourselves from this cycle by really looking at the link of feeling. This is something that it's taught a lot, you know, that one of the ways to break this cycle is to really orient towards the aspect of feeling in our experience, to really notice when something's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that noticing can tend to kind of short-circuit the automatic movement to craving. And so we can free ourselves from the kind of subsequent conditioning that tends to happen if we focus on that link of feeling. And the Buddha did actually emphasize exploring feeling tone a lot. It's a big piece of the practice that the Buddha taught. Explore feeling tone. Notice when it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Just know that. And yet, in another teaching, the Buddha also pointed to the possibility of exploring with a practice with any place in this chain. There's a teaching. And for those of you who like references, this is in Majjhima 9, where the Buddha, or actually it's Shariputra, I think, who gives this teaching. And in this teaching, the entire set of links are reviewed as being, and here's a way you practice with this link. So I'll read one. I'll read the one about clinging. Actually, I'll paraphrase and read one about mental formations instead. Mental formations, pretty much any mind state that arises is a mental formation. And so first I'll read it with respect to just that bare thing of mental formation. So just think about this with respect to any emotion that arises. When one has understood formations, the origin of formations, the cessation of formations, and the way leading to the cessation of formations, one entirely abandons the underlying tendency to greed, aversion, and delusion, and extirpates the underlying tendency towards the conceit, I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, one here and now makes an end to suffering. When one has understood anger, the origin of anger, the ending of anger, and the way leading to the ending of anger, one here and now makes an end to suffering. And so we don't have to wait until we find some, like, pure understanding of feeling tone. We can meet whatever is arising with this simple practice of mindfulness. This simple practice of, this is what's arising right now. We understand the arising of anger. We understand the conditions that lead to the arising of anger. That usually happens as we notice it over time. We may see it release. This practice of mindfulness and wisdom with any experience leads to freedom. Now, it doesn't matter what we're paying attention to. It can be a state of anger or a state of bliss. It can be the contact of a sense impression as we touch a doorknob. When we bring this quality of mindfulness, we are undermining that tendency to aversion, right? That tendency to ignorance right now. And as we taste those releases, I talked about some of the flavors of release. As we taste that, we taste the flavor of the Dhamma. And we gain a refuge in the Dharma that points to a trust in the practices and teachings that will lead us towards this freedom. So let's just sit for a few seconds.